Hi, this is science comedian Brian Mallow, and you're listening to the SF Signal podcast.
This is the SF Signal podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is the interview episode for the week. I had a chance to sit down with science comedian Brian Mallow, and here's what he had to say. Tonight, I'm joined by Earth's premier science comedian, Brian Mallow. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Patrick. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
So how does one become a science comedian?
I don't want to give away all my secrets. You just become a comedian the standard way. But what happens is you're already kind of a science and science fiction geek your whole life. So when you become a comedian, it's pretty natural that it's kind of geeky. So it comes out a little geeky. I can't help it. I didn't really plan it that way. So it always was kind of science geeky. It took me a long time to realize I should call it that. Just call it science comedy and go see if the domain sciencecomedian.com is available. And when it was available, I was like, that's either a really good sign or a really bad sign.
So, how do you decide what you're going to talk about in your act? I mean, you know, you've got like all these quote unquote regular comedians talking about relationships and, you know, oh, my girl says this, or, oh, my boy says that, or blah, 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 blah. You know, how do you build a science comedy act?
Well, I think that a lot of comedians would probably say this, the same thing, that, a lot of our stuff is somewhat unplanned. It just comes out of spontaneous situations. Because look, like a lot of times when we are funniest is when we're just hanging with your, you know, best friends and you say something off the cuff. You're in an ideal situation where you're funniest with your, you know, pals or your girlfriend or something. And some stuff just comes out spontaneously. And comedians get very good. They learn to keep a notebook and to write stuff down. So it could be anything like that. And then there's other stuff that you set out to actually write where you go, you know what? I need some material about global warming, or I need some material about chemistry. I got a gig for the American Chemical Society, and I'm like, I need some chemistry humor. So sometimes you do set out to do it. You know, I do the same sort of thing. I might have some stuff about relationships, but I'll try to bring the language of science or metaphors, analogies, you know, it'll be a science perspective, but it's still hitting some of the same stuff. So I might touch on relationships. You know, a line that I kind of like is when I say that women have passed through my life like exotic particles through a cloud chamber, leaving only vapor trails for me to study for clues to their nature. So, you know, it's just your standard relationship bit with a little bit of chemistry or physics thrown in.
Yeah, for some reason, I was imagining you up on stage going, what is it about the space shuttle?
Right. Yeah, what's up with the space shuttle? There's a little of that, too, you know. So there's talking about topics like that. But sometimes you just totally stumble upon them. And I'll tell you a science fiction one, which I imagine I might have told you this before. But I was on the web, and I stumbled upon a website that it was a page that had a list of science fiction titles in Spanish. And I scrolled down and I saw the classic Isaac Asimov book, I, Robot, which in Spanish is Yo, Robot. So it's like sometimes the jokes just write themselves. I don't have anything else to say except Yo, Robot. I just love that. And if you don't believe it, Google the phrase. Google Yo, Robot, and you'll see a bunch of book covers, and you'll see the movie poster for Will Smith, and they all say Yo, Robot.
Oh, wow.
It's awesome. Yeah.
I'm doing this massive like archiving project at work where I'm having to scan all these pictures, and I come across a picture of the IT director from – he's the IT director now, but back in the day he wasn't. But this is from like 95, 96, something like that. And I scanned this picture and I sent it to him. And I said, how did I put it? I said, yo, where's Biv and DeVoe? because he had the hair and he had the big glasses. I mean, it was just hilarious. Anyway,
right.
When you say things that, you know, that just kind of come to you anyway. Right. I thought it was funny. Nobody else is laughing as usual. I'm sad. What is an example of like chemistry humor?
Well, some stuff like, I noticed a long time ago, whenever my mom would lose weight, my dad would gain weight. And whenever my dad lost weight, my mom gained weight. It was like the conservation of mass within our family. And, you know, I had this theory that you never actually lose weight. You just give it to somebody else. Fat can be neither created nor destroyed. It's one of the basic laws of the universe. But, I mean, if you want something a little more obscure, like, you know, there's some that I can tell to just about any audience or any geeky audience like that. I used to tell that joke at comedy clubs that weren't even expecting science comedy. But then there's some jokes that are for a more limited audience. So because I was doing a room full of chemists, I said that they had asked me if I can be off the cuff. And I said, I'm so spontaneous, I have a negative delta G. Which now no one should laugh at that unless they really know their chemistry. Because what it means is delta G is a measurement. It was a pun. On spontaneous. They asked me if I could be spontaneous. Well, spontaneity is it's a measure of how readily a chemical reaction will happen. Like, you know, some reactions happen very easily and others you have to put energy into them to make them happen. So if something has a negative delta G, that means that it's very spontaneous. It's a reaction that can happen very easily. It doesn't take much to make it happen. So it was a pun, and it's obscure, and it's totally lost in having to explain it all. Although it's interesting. Maybe it's a way to learn a little. Hey, we all learn a little. Okay? Laugh a little, learn a little.
There you go. Now, you ground all this, obviously, in science, but also you have a science fiction background.
So I do.
You grew up reading science fiction. So what kind of things influenced you?
Well, the stuff that I grew up on and started reading when I was in like junior high and high school, junior high, maybe younger, but definitely junior high, was Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Larry Niven. I would say those were my big three back then. And I read some H.G. Wells and maybe some Ray Bradbury. But the stuff I really got into, me and my friends, was the hard science stuff. Asimov, Clarke, and have you read Larry Niven, for instance?
Have
you
I have not. Those? No. And as anybody who listens to the podcast know, I used to think I was really well-read, and then I met Karen Burnham.
Really? Yeah. Well, you know what? We read, me and my little geeky friends, too, we read, you know, Asimov and Clarke also wrote a lot of nonfiction, and we learned a lot of our science. We were good students, but we learned a lot of our science from Asimov and from Clarke, from their science books. As far as science fiction goes, Asimov, a lot of short stories. And the book that I always liked as my favorite of his was called The Gods Themselves. That was a great novel. And for Arthur C. Clarke, Childhood's End. It's a classic. Most people, I think, that know that book, when Independence Day came out, and all of a sudden, you know, there's this scene where these giant ships appear over 50 major cities on the planet. That is basically the opening of Childhood's End. And I think that all the old timers that love that book, that kind of pissed us off. We're like, oh man, it was like kind of cool to see it visualized, but it was even cooler because it was a book in the 50s and it was the beginning of Childhood's End is the space race. And the Russians and the Americans are trying to beat each other into space. And that's when these gigantic mile-long ships appear over all the cities, major cities of the world. And it's like, well, that sort of ended the space race, didn't it? So it was even cooler and more dramatic. And they weren't here to destroy us either.
You know what else pissed a lot of people off? Just this year, you know, a movie was released that basically explained that the space race was all about getting to the dark side of the moon because that's where the Decepticons were.
Oh, is that the new Transformers?
Yeah.
I haven't. Have you seen it?
I have. Did I just spoil it for everybody? I'm sorry. Well, I mean, it's all in the trailer.
Yeah. But so is it any good? Is it worth seeing?
I actually did enjoy it. And I know there's a lot of people rolling their eyes right now and thinking, oh my God. But I, you know what? I, even though it was massively long, it was 2.5 hours
really?
Long.
Yeah.
And I did see it in 3D. And I have to say, there's no point in paying for 3D. Just go see it regular.
You know? Really? It wasn't, the 3D is not that good.
No, I didn't see a point to the 3D.
Okay. So, did you see a point to the 3D in Avatar?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Avatar used 3D really, really well. Transformers 3, like most of these movies now, it's just, you know, can we get 10 more bucks out of you?
I know.
And yeah. So, you know, I didn't see a point to the only thing. Okay, here you go. The only reason I liked the 3D was because I got to see the Captain America trailer in 3D.
Oh.
And when he threw that shield at me, I jumped.
Cool.
But for the most part, the Transformers flick, there was no point in having the 3D. But, yeah. You know, it was an entertaining movie. It was better, I think, than the others. It actually had a little bit of a plot for a change. Spock played one of the Transformers.
What?
Leonard Nimoy is a Transformer in this, yes.
That's bizarre. Have you seen that music video that Nimoy stars in?
Yes,
that is the funniest thing. I love him so much more for that. It's so funny.
We actually had that on sfsignal.com. We put that on a post.
What was it? It's something about a day, like, I don't want to do anything.
Yep.
Something about not wanting to do anything today.
He's walking around in his robe and he's flipping people off. Yeah.
When he kind of just, that guy, his neighbor says hi to him and he just plants his palm in on his head and pushes him away. It's so funny. It's the whole thing is. Okay. So let me take you back to, so when I started getting into hard science, I really liked the kind of science fiction that we were science geeks and we loved the science fiction that tried to be scientifically accurate. Mm-hmm. And that's a great tradition. And Larry Niven, his stuff, I don't know what it's like for someone who's younger and has been exposed to all this newer stuff to go back and read it. But I would still have to think that a bunch of the Niven books are still amazing. And Ringworld, of course, is his most famous book. And maybe a collection of short stories called Tales of Known Space. But he has a lot of great books. World of Ptahv. He has some very hard to pronounce aliens and names like Ptahvs, P-T-A-V-V-S or something. But Protector and what else? Ringworld and the Ringworld Engineers and A World Out of Time. Just great books. But you've got to check out Ringworld. It's a classic. If I'm not mistaken, it won the Hugo and the Nebula, or at least one of them. Great book.
So you grew up, you know, reading the science fiction stuff. At what point do you decide that you want to be a comedian? I mean, was there a different career path before you went down this one?
Well, And so me and this one particular geeky friend of mine, we loved science. We thought about being scientists, but then we also started writing songs together, my lyrics to his music. And we kind of thought maybe we could be rock stars. Yeah, rock stars are scientists, kind of like maybe both, maybe scientist by day, rock star at night, some kind of cross between Einstein and Freddie Mercury, or, you know, without the sexual connotations of Einstein, I mean. And so that didn't really pan out. It's not like we pursued it that hard, but ultimately, no, it wasn't like I was into comedy in terms of when I was young, we had like a Saturday Night Live album and some Monty Python albums. I had some George Carlin and Richard Pryor albums in the house. So there was stuff that was influential on my sense of humor, but it wasn't until I was much older that I really started thinking about it. And once when I was in, Austin, Texas, where I went to the University of Texas. I actually did some grad school in radio, TV, and film. And it was at the start of grad school that I saw a Funniest Person in Austin contest. And I decided to try it because I had given some thought to it. But I wasn't much of a stage person. I was kind of shy. I didn't have stage experience when I was young. So it was like really my first times on stage when I got up and did stand-up. But I got a taste of it, and I really liked it, and stuck with it.
The first, you know, you mentioned all those albums, and you know, I know that my my aunt, my uncle, my parents, they were listening like to the Bill Cosby albums,
right?
You know?
Right.
Of course, my brother and my cousins and stuff were listening to Richard Pryor, or what was his name? Red Fox.
Mm-hmm.
you know, a little bit more blue.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I think it was my freshman year in high school, we took a class trip somewhere, and my friend, we were in the bus driving from like Fresno to San Francisco or something like that. And my friend handed me a cassette and he said, "You have got to listen to this." And I popped it into my Walkman and hit play, and it was Eddie Murphy's Delirious.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I was in tears listening to that. People were wondering what the hell was going on. I was dying. It was so funny.
Yep, that was a big one for me. I remember, I'm not sure when it came out, but maybe high school or something. And I remember it as an HBO special or something on video, not just the audio. And he's wearing the slick red jump, you know, suit that he was wearing. And yep, that was early stuff that I still remember.
ice cream man. Yep. You ain't got no ice cream. You ain't got no ice cream.
Yep.
So, okay. So you've done a lot of different shows. You've gone to NASA. You've gone to where else? JPL.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have some NASA people who are involved with SF Signal. What kind of stuff did you do for NASA?
Well, I've done a couple things. One is out here in the Bay Area in Mountain View is NASA Ames Research Center, and I've done a performance there. I also visited there because, you know, I make these science videos for Time Magazine's website, time.com.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And one of the pieces I did had to do with helium. And one thing they're doing at NASA Ames is they rent out some space on their campus to some interesting businesses. And one of the businesses is called Airship Ventures, and they have a dirigible. They have a Zeppelin made by the original Zeppelin company. And their business is based there, and they take people on tours. So I actually got to ride on this Zeppelin because it's a big bag of helium, so it fit in with our project really well. So one of my visits there, like, just has to do with shooting something there. And then JPL. I have a friend that was a JPL rocket scientist, and one time when I was down in the Southern California, we just set it up in advance. It's like, hey, yeah, I'd love to get a little tour of JPL. And while I'm there, he set it up that I performed for a little group of the people that were working on Cassini. That was the project he was working on, you know, that's out there around studying Saturn and its moons. So I did a little performance for some JPL people. And now more recently, I've done a few things with the National Science Foundation, the NSF, and the AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And actually some of that is I've done some workshops teaching scientists how to be better speakers.
Hmm.
And in one case, the NSF, they hired me to give a workshop called Communicating Science with Humor. So the idea was not just to teach them how to be better presenters, but how could they, without telling them to try to be comedians, how they could maybe add a little humor, you know, find the kind of humor that anyone could do. Like, you know, a lot of it, one of the things I had to say was about using analogies. Analogies are great for communication in general, and they're also great for humorous potential. Like that conservation of mass bit, you know, you turn it into an analogy like that and it becomes very funny.
So give us some examples of the kind of bits you do for them.
Well, there's like that and,
sorry to put you on the spot. I just thought, I like I said, I know some people who work for NASA, and I just was curious, you know,
what
you kind of touch on?
Well, I do have a bit about how I used to be an astronomer, but I got stuck on the day shift, which sucks because you don't discover anything good, you know? And then really, if I have a savvy audience, I do have to explain that I know there's solar astronomers and radio astronomers that work on the day shift. And if you really want to get technical, nowadays, pretty much all astronomers work on the day shift. Because the days of astronomers sitting in the dark and peering through a telescope, that's a pretty rare thing for a professional astronomer. Amateur astronomers do that. But professional astronomers, they tend to use really big telescopes that are computer controlled, and all the data is gathered digitally, and they can crunch the data and look at it during the daytime. So that's kind of an interesting joke. I kind of like that idea, actually, where a joke could be a doorway into some more information. And then some stuff just sillier, like something that I've found very funny recently is I said that my girlfriend called me one in a, said something about me being one in a million, which sounds like a great compliment until you realize there's about 7 billion people on the planet. So that's like one in 7,000. It's like, it's not the great compliment that it used to be. Like maybe back in 10,000 BC or right after the Black Death, that was a nice compliment. But now that is a phrase that has suffered from inflation. One in a billion. And then really, I want to take it to the next step. I really want to take that joke and find out, I think maybe take the square, you know, the how many square miles, the surface area of the Earth, maybe the surface area of just the land mass, and then divide that in. So 7,000 of me spread over however many X number of square miles, how many of me per square mile? I think that would be a really geeky way to top off that joke.
So what is this project you're doing for Time?
Well, for Time, I've been, over the past 2 years, I've made a bunch of videos, short videos for, they're on time.com. If you go to time.com/video, you can find them. You can also find them in my blog, at sciencecomedian.com. If you go to time.com/video and you spell my name correctly, Mallow with one L, M-A-L-O-W, you can do a search there and find all the videos I've made. And so some of them are kind of funny. A couple of them are kind of straighter. They're, you know, I love science as much as I love comedy. So I can feel really comfortable doing a science piece that has no humor in it. One of the ones we did was about the Herschel Space Observatory. And I was working with another producer and editor, and that one was pretty straight. I don't think there was really any humor in it. But a couple of the other pieces are pretty funny. There's a time, you know, I got, here's something. I have a routine about time travel. And we made one of my more successful and more popular videos on Time is something like, is time travel scientifically possible? Or something like that is the title. And basically it's my jokes turned into a video for Time. Well, a writer that is a friend of mine, he's in the UK, he lives in Wales, his name's John Gilby, he proposed, after listening to my CD, he was inspired and thought that part of that joke would make a great short story. And so he wrote it up and sent it to me, and I made some changes, and we went back and forth. And the windup is, he's published a bunch of short stories in the back page of Nature magazine. Now, Nature is one of the premier science journals that publishes actually scholarly papers in science, but they have this feature, I think it's called Futures, and it's a very short sort of one-page science fiction story. It's the kind of short story that I grew up, you know what, that's the other thing about, like Asimov wrote some really short stories, that kind that in between classes, you could go to the library and read the shortest, you know, get a book of short stories, turn to the table of contents and find the shortest one and go, I have time to read this. And if really short stories are kind of the same as jokes. Like I noticed that when I got into comedy, ultimately I realized an interesting connection there because the kind of short stories that I first started writing, really short, they're very much like jokes. They're one idea with kind of a twist or a punchline at the end, like a Twilight Zone episode. You know what I mean?
Dun, 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 dun.
So the wind-up
is... I used to love Twilight Zone, by the
way. Yes, me too. So we wrote this story, and actually I think it comes out in Nature. I'm actually going to have my first science fiction story that I co-authored published in Nature, I think on August 11th, coming right up.
Very cool.
So yeah, watch for that. And it's just, it's a silly little story based, inspired by one of my jokes that a friend of mine saw that it could be expanded into a short story. So see, me and John Gilby.
See, you already kind of lost me because my brain's already going, you unlock this door with the key of imagination.
That's right.
Beyond it is another dimension. No, that's awesome. So what was the, I mean, is it going to spoil it if you tell us a little bit about
the
time travel?
Oh yeah, I'll just say it's about time travel and leave it at that. It's, like I said, my CD, he had my CD. So I have a CD called Rational Comedy for an Irrational Planet, which is available at sciencecomedian.com. And so the bit is on there, and then it's also in this Time video that you can see. And then this written version is a little different. It fleshes it out like a story. But a very short story, just a one pager, basically one or two pages.
So you've got the CD available on the website. I want a little teaser from the CD. So
cool.
So give us something from the CD.
I think we have a clip. Oh, you want me to give you a teaser?
I want you to get, yeah, come on.
I think I probably already did. Like, I think the conservation of mass is probably on there, and that cloud chamber bit is on there. How about the one in a million thing? That's not, because that's new. What else is on there?
Robot Uprising.
The Robot Uprising. God, you know, it's been so long that I'm not even sure I remember how that goes. I say that I don't actually fear a robot uprising, but I do keep a couple hostages in my shed, you know, like a Roomba, you know, just in case something goes down, I'll be in a better bargaining position, you know. Which, by the way, speaking of robots, I would say too that even though, so I grew up on the hard science, and the science fiction I loved was like that. Then later I got into other stuff, and Philip K. Dick became one of my favorites, and Roger Zelazny and Philip Jose Farmer. And these guys, you wouldn't put it, they're not that same genre. They're not the hard science. They're different. And I still love the hard science, but I really went head over heels for Dick, PKD. And
not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right. You know, there's actually his very famous book that Blade Runner's based on asks a question that I've never heard anyone else answer, but I think I have the definitive answer. The question is, the title of the book, do androids dream of electric sheep? And the ones in the Deep South do, but the others dream of electric French maids. That's my answer. Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Oh, that's bad. I'm stuck on Seinfeld because he's selling his house here in Colorado.
And you're thinking of buying?
Yeah, and I just know. Yeah, if I, you know, I was thinking, gosh, if, you know, I've got $20 million, what could I do with it?
Maybe
I
guess a second home, right?
Yeah, buy Seinfeld's old house. Oh well.
He's got a house in Colorado.
He's got a house in Telluride. Yeah.
Of course.
And he's selling, and so it's made like all the local news here. Oh my God, Jerry Seinfeld's selling his house. Big deal.
That's some kind of science fiction.
Happens all the time.
So who do you, so then I'll tell you, let me toss out a couple other names and tell me someone that you read. Like, but now, especially because of an event, I attended an event called Launchpad. It's actually going on right now. And it's a fascinating thing. There's a guy named Mike Brotherton who's an astronomy. He's an astronomer and astronomy professor at the University of Wisconsin. And I'm sorry, Wyoming. in Cheyenne or something. And he is also a science fiction writer with a couple of hard science fiction novels. Star Dragon and Spider Star. Is that, can't think of the name of the second one. But he got some NASA funding and some NSF funding to put on a workshop for a week to teach science fiction writers how to bring them up to speed with modern astronomy so that when they write their science fiction, it'll have good astronomy in it. So each year he has about a dozen science fiction writers, and I got to attend with my girlfriend's my writing partner, and she's now my fiance. And we attended a couple years ago, and Joe Haldeman was one of the guest instructors, which was awesome. And Robert J. Sawyer is a great writer who was one of the attendees. So these are some people that have become friends of mine, and I've become huge fans of their writing. So there's some newer guys that I really like. Haldeman, Sawyer, and some others.
Well, see, and one of the things that I've been very open about with the SF Signal community is the fact that I haven't read a lot of science fiction. I read mostly fantasy, like epic fantasy.
Okay, like
George R. R. Martin,
okay, yeah,
Robert Jordan, Terry Goodkind before he started to suck.
Do you have the new George R. R. Martin? We it's coming tomorrow.
I don't.
I haven't read any of them, but my fiance has been waiting for this book for years. She's a huge fan.
Yeah, I still haven't read the one before this.
Okay.
Because it pissed me off. So, you know, maybe I'll get Dance of Dragons to read them together. Because it's supposed to be one book that they split.
Did you watch the series?
I did, and I loved the series. Yeah, and see that's the other thing. For me, you know, I watched a lot of science fiction.
Right.
I didn't read a lot of science fiction. So, sure. You know, I you know, you start talking about Babylon 5 and Star Trek and Time Tracks and
what's your favorite Star Trek?
You mean series or movies?
Series.
Actually Voyager.
Really?
Yeah, I liked Voyager.
Huh. I liked Voyager, but I think I got to go with the original Trek or Next Generation. Kind of hard to say. I feel like the original Trek needs to, like, there would be no Star Trek without the original Trek. And, you know, Spock and Kirk, how can you?
True, but, you know. Props,
but really, Voyager?
I really enjoyed Voyager. I did.
Hmm.
And then, you know, obviously I read all the comics.
Yeah.
So I had the Marvel. I had the DC. I did not have the Gold Key. That's before my time.
Hmm.
But I did have all those Star Trek comics.
I knew the Star Trek animated show when I was a kid. I saw some of that.
Yep.
And actually, one or two episodes, one for sure, was based on a Larry Niven story. It's called The Slaver Weapon. I'm not sure if that's the name of the episode. But yeah, there's this one that's based on, and it may have been written by Larry Niven.
That's very cool. You know, and I liked, I mean, I read a lot of the Star Trek novels because people would give them to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would just have, someone would, you know, say, here, I'm like 11 years old, and a friend of my mom's would say, here, and hand me a box, and it's full of Star Trek novels.
Yeah.
And so I read, you know, believe it or not, I read a lot of authors who write other things
right.
now, like DC Fontana. Uh-huh. Diane Duane, Peter David, who went on to like do The Incredible Hulk, and then he wrote some other stuff. Kevin J. Anderson wrote a couple.
You know, Joe Haldeman wrote a couple.
Vonda McIntyre.
Yeah.
And back when they first started, it was a continuity. And so all the authors worked off of each other, and what happened in one story could be mentioned in another, and it was kind of a continuity. And then Paramount stopped that. They didn't like it. And now I guess it's back to they are doing related stories again and a continuity. For a very long time, they're kind of in the middle. All the stories were standalone and were not supposed to be part of any sort of canon.
Hmm.
So anyway, you know, I grew up reading a lot of that kind of stuff and then got into the epic fantasy. I already mentioned Jordan and Martin and Goodkind, but also Modisset, Dennis L. McKiernan, Kate Elliott, J.V. Jones, Julie Jones, Kristen Bertain. There's a lot of...
Julie, okay, I haven't read any of that. I haven't read any big fantasy like that. But I did meet, you mentioned Julie Jones. She was one of the attendees at this launch pad a couple years ago. So I met her, but I haven't read her. Yeah. And you know what? One of the other attendees had a very well-received first fantasy novel out this past year. N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, she wrote a book called The 100,000 Kingdoms.
Yep.
And it was huge. I think it was a Nebula nominee, and it was her first novel. And I think her second one is already out. It's a trilogy.
Yeah, everybody does a trilogy now. There's no standalone novels anymore. No standalone novels. They just don't exist.
Yeah, so I don't know that much fantasy, but I did. But Roger Zelazny is a very interesting case where I think you'd have to categorize most of his stuff as fantasy, but sometimes it's a strange mix of science fiction and fantasy. Like it has some neat science fiction aspects to it, and he was an amazing writer. Amazing.
Well, see, now recently I've read Scalzi.
Okay, yeah.
Like Old Man's War.
Yeah, I haven't read that.
I liked that a lot. But I'm struggling with The Last Colony to kind of get through it. So, but you know, I liked Old Man's War. I liked Ghost Brigade. So far, Last Colony, I'm not 100% there yet.
Have you read John Shirley?
Nope.
He's a guy I've met. He's out here in San Francisco. And so we met at an event where I performed, and he's come out to one of my shows, and we're Facebook friends.
Yeah, I had someone that sent me a request for Facebook today, and she said, "Why aren't we friends?"
Yeah,
and I said, "We are friends. We just didn't publicize it on Facebook."
I know. Yeah, I just connected with a very old friend, and it's like, oh, we weren't friends on here. Like, what is it? Yeah, the weird thing. It's kind of disturbing. There's a bunch of people that I found out like I found out a couple people shared my birthday, and the whole time we knew each other, we never knew it until Facebook told us. I think that's a little sad.
That is a little bit sad. Do you go to cons?
You know, interestingly, I've just had to turn down an invitation to some con in Portland called OriCon, I think.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because they weren't offering to fly me in and put me up and pay me. But that one was sort of skewed towards horror. And, I've been to some, but,
I'm going to tell you right now, dude, there's not any of these science fiction conventions are going to fly you in and pay you.
Yeah, I know.
You know, at most they're going to comp you for the con.
Right, right. Well, that's nice. I mean, but they invited me. I didn't approach them. So, you know, it's a little, it seems a little strange, but I understand that there's definite, limited budgets for these, but, I haven't been to any of the really big ones.
Have you ever gone just as a fan?
No, I haven't. And I've been meaning to go to eat like Comic-Con or Dragon Con. I was almost involved in Dragon Con a couple years ago, but it hasn't happened yet. Have you been to Dragon Con?
I have not, although both our podcasts are nominated for Parsecs.
Ah, cool.
There's also the World Science Fiction Convention is going to be in Reno in August.
Hmm.
And the World Fantasy Convention is going to be in San Diego in October.
Oh, I was at the World, I think it was the World Fantasy Convention in San Jose about a year ago.
Two
years ago? Yeah. Because a couple people, because I knew that Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison was going to be there, and a couple other people. So, and it was right down there in San Jose. So I attended that one as a fan.
So how does your science fiction kind of influence your comedy?
Well, it's just, you know, like what I read for fun and for work, it's the same thing to me. It's like I have a nice kind of job where I like what I do and everything feeds into it. So I just, you know, I get maybe inspiration from some of the stuff. Like one of the recent guys that I have read, although not too recently, Greg Egan. I don't know if you know, he's another hard science guy. And I read a couple of his books, Permutation City and Diaspora. And oh my God, they have some pretty mind blowing ideas. They're pretty, imaginative books. And Charlie Strauss, the book, Accelerando. Oh my God, that is an amazing book. I love it. And it's about the singularity, essentially. It's about, it covers a pretty vast period of time. It jumps in time in a few instances. And so you see technology just leaping forward with augmented humans and just amazing technology. So Accelerando was one of the most mind-blowing books I read this past year. And he's written in several different genres. So he's written a couple singularity-type books, but he's also written some completely different genres that are more like some kind of detective stories. I haven't read them yet, but I will because I love his voice. So that kind of stuff just feeds in the same way that all the science stuff I read, whether it's online or in magazines, it's just really good food for thought. Because science fiction writers, I think that what I do is kind of analogous to what a science fiction writer does. We love science and we use it to make art. I like to make comedy out of these science ideas and science language and concepts and explore those worlds in humorous ways. And a science fiction writer takes, you know, science and extrapolates and tries to dream up interesting extrapolations in worlds and in prose. So I've always thought there's an interesting little little camaraderie there with science fiction writers. I think we're doing something similar, making art out of science.
Absolutely. So why don't we start to wrap this up a little bit. Why don't you tell people your website, your Twitter, your Facebook, all that kind of good
stuff. Sure. I'm very easy to find. I'm Science Comedian on everything, on Twitter, on YouTube. Science Comedian Brian Mallow is my Facebook page. And sciencecomedian.com. So if you Google Science Comedian, you'll find tons of references to me. But most of the stuff is right there on my website. And I point to the videos that I've done for Time, and you can find my videos on Time. I also contribute some audio pieces to Neil deGrasse Tyson's radio show. So he is our rock star scientist, astrophysicist, that has a public radio show called Star Talk Radio.
Yes, and wasn't Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory invited to be on that?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
I believe that was an episode of The Big Bang Theory where Sheldon was invited to come on the show and talk about something. And one of the other scientists fed a tube into his office and started shooting helium in. Huh. So here he is on NPR. He's so proud to be on there. And he's talking like...
That's great. I know that Neil Tyson has been on Big Bang Theory. I saw him on there once. He was on briefly on a different episode. So I'm not sure if that was him or not in that one. But so there you go. I can sometimes be heard on Star Talk Radio. You can find me on time.com. And you can find me mostly science comedian. That'll lead you to me.
Very cool.
Follow me on Twitter, blah, blah, blah.
Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Brian for coming on the show. You guys should be checking out sfsignal.com each and every day for all kinds of really great stuff. You should also be following John D. on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal. Hey, this is going to be the last episode for a couple of weeks because I'm going to Worldcon, and hopefully I'm going to come back with at least a couple of interviews for you guys. But getting ready for that, I'm going to take a little bit of break here. And then we're going to come back after Worldcon. So look for us around the third or fourth week of August to return. So other than that, you know, follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/ATFMB. That's where I'll be. And when I'm at Worldcon in Reno, who knows, I'll probably be tweeting quite a bit. Or maybe I won't be tweeting at all. We don't know. Depends on how AT&T does there and how the Wi-Fi works. As to whether or not my phone can actually connect. I'm sure that it's a huge big city, and you know it's a touristy city, and there's tons of people there all the time. So I'm pretty confident that AT&T won't have any coverage whatsoever for their iPhones. Yeah, that's me making a joke. It was the science comedian's fault. He inspired me. Anyway, so that's it for us for at least a couple of weeks. We will be back with more panels and more interviews after Worldcon. Thanks, folks. I will see you after Worldcon. Bye.